From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, a live exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Coming up on the program, a conversation with Melanie Zamora, Director of Housing Programs at The Road Home, in the second of our three-part series on homelessness.
I often talk about how hard people have to work to get out of homelessness. We are not giving them services. They have to work. As much as it's a kind interaction and we try to be compassionate and guide people through the process, it's hard and there are lots of stumbles along the way.
Also, a look at the science of earthquakes in Utah and a local news summary. All that just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First, this world news from the BBC. And you're listening to The Rundown, a news and information show where we look at emerging stories, current events, politics, and ideas. Here on the program, you can hear conversations with local newsmakers, trailblazers, cultural entrepreneurs, and more. Later in the program, the second in our three-part series on homelessness, a discussion with Melanie Zamora, Director of Housing Programs at The Road Home. But we begin today with a visit to a Salt Lake City senior center. On Thursday morning, more than 100 people came to the 10th East Senior Center in downtown Salt Lake City to celebrate that facility's 50th anniversary. The day began with music and dancing. Rosie Hallstrom is a singer in the band Harmony 5. She says their band travels around to all of the senior centers doing gigs and believes that all seniors should consider joining a center.
I recommend this for every senior in the world. I do. It gives you life. It gives you spirit. It's just wonderful.
The 10th East Senior Center was one of the first in the United States and the very first in Utah when it opened in 1963. Today, there are 19 centers in the Salt Lake Valley that provide activities, music, dancing, and exercise programs, including yoga and even Tai Chi. Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams addressed the group on what he called a momentous occasion.
Our older Americans' knowledge, wisdom, and experience have helped shape our past and present and will play a role in defining our future. So here's to 50 more years.
And now on The Rundown, we turn to a look at the science behind Utah earthquakes. You wouldn't know it from experience, but the Wasatch Front is one of the most seismically at-risk areas in Utah and in the Intermountain West. Scientists are looking at thousands of years of earthquake history to learn more about the hazards we face. KCPW's Kim Shusky has this story.
In Christchurch, New Zealand, in February of 2011, a 6.3 earthquake struck 6 miles from the city center. This recording was captured during a lecture at a local university. The earthquake caused the ground to basically liquefy during the shaking because of the sandy type of soil present in the area. Close to 200 people died, and recent estimates put the cost of rebuilding at $40 billion. Chris DuRoss is a senior geologist at the Utah Geological Survey.
Liquefaction occurs during earthquake shaking, basically a soil that is strong before the earthquake during the shaking loses its strength and essentially behaves like a liquid, more or less like quicksand.
Buildings and other structures can be partially sucked into the earth, and once the shaking stops, the loose, sandy, saturated soil solidifies, returning to its original state. This is one reason why the Christchurch earthquake caused so much damage. Much of the infrastructure along the Wasatch Front is built on similar type of soil, says DuRoss.
Just like in Christchurch, we could have strong ground shaking, and we have soils that are susceptible to liquefaction.
But he cautions that the type of fault along the Wasatch Front is different than in Christchurch. He adds there are ongoing studies of the potential for liquefaction in Salt Lake Valley, which should help to better define the risk. What is not in question is that we are due for a 6.5 to 7.5 earthquake.
It's correct to say that we could have an earthquake at any time. Basically, enough seismic energy has accumulated on the fault. The fault's been sitting here without any movement for long enough that we could have a large earthquake.
The area has been settled for over 150 years, but unlike in California, there have not been any large earthquakes during this time. So how do they know one is coming? Duras says they know it because his group has looked at prehistoric earthquakes, those that have happened over thousands of years. They know where the faults are, so they dig trenches across fault scarps or scars in the earth to get a better look at the disruptions caused by earthquakes. They can see vertical displacement of the ground's surface and can date the geologic deposits. This gives a detailed historical record of the quakes. Using this method, it's been found that there have been about 4 earthquakes in the last 5,000 years on the Salt Lake City segment of the Wasatch Fault.
Now in Salt Lake City, we have earthquakes that occur about every 1,300 years over the last 5,000 years of history of the fault. We call that a return period or recurrence time, so about 1,300 years between magnitude 7 earthquakes. And it's been about 1,400 years since the last large earthquake.
Duras says one of the concerns in Utah is that since we haven't experienced earthquakes, building codes over the last century have not taken into account the seismic nature of the area. Basically, any house or building built before the 1970s may be at risk from shaking and liquefaction, depending on the epicenter and strength of the next big one.
Yeah, we have building stock. We call these unreinforced masonry buildings. These were built in the 20s and 30s and 40s up to about the 60s. And these are typically brick homes that you see all throughout, say, Sugar House and other areas. And the bricks are just stacked up. And while they're historic buildings and they look great, they're not designed to withstand horizontal motions that occur during ground shaking from a large earthquake. And so they tend to have considerable damage and even failure.
Data from the Federal Emergency Management Agency suggests damage in Salt Lake City from a large earthquake will run over $42 billion, and 9,000 people will suffer life-threatening injuries or death. Duras says the best thing for people to do to prepare is to strap down your water heater, have an earthquake kit available with food and water, and have an earthquake plan ready for your family, schools, and place of work. For KCBW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
Now on the rundown, we turn to the second in a 3-part series on homelessness. Originally, we were slated to have Matt Minkovich, executive director of The Road Home, on the program today. But because of a scheduling change, we spoke instead with that organization's Melanie Zamora. Our conversation looked at the broader whys of homelessness in the area and at the services available to the local homeless population. Melanie, thanks for joining us, first off.
Thank you for having me.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar, can you give me a quick overview of who The Road Home is?
Sure. So The Road Home is the largest homeless shelter in the state of Utah and the largest, of course, in the Wasatch Front. We serve as sort of a catchment for a vast majority of people who experience literal homelessness in our state. And people come to us for all sorts of services. Our emergency room, as we view it, is shelter. So we shelter anywhere from 700 to 1,000 people a night, depending on the season, typically. In the winter months, we open an additional facility, 2 additional facilities. We have our main facility is in downtown Salt Lake, and then we open up a family shelter in Midvale in the winter months, as well as we partner with Catholic Community Services to utilize St. Vincent de Paul, which is the community dining room down in the shelter area, and we lease out their floor space for men who are intoxicated in the winter, so they're not outside freezing. Those are our essential services.
The Road Home was one of several parties involved in the recent transient camp cleanup in City Creek Canyon. Can you tell me about your organization's role in that cleanup effort?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that the Salt Lake City Police Department has been very supportive of what we do. And, you know, we meet with them regularly and partner with them on different initiatives. And that's been really so helpful for everything we do. We knew that the clearing was going to take place well before the date that they were going to go out. And our role in that is sort of to watch what those entities are doing and know when it's happening, and then welcome anyone who wants to come into shelter with open arms. We never turn anyone away, and you know, we're there all the time for anyone who needs resources. And once they're in the door, you know, we provide as many wraparound services as possible to help people be somewhere more permanent in their lives and not have to camp if that's what they want to do.
And I'm wondering, sometimes people reject those services. I'm wondering why people actually decline services. Like, what is the reasoning behind that?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. So first of all, I want to back up a little bit from the cleanup and talk about our partners at Volunteers of America.
Sure.
They are the outreach provider in the community, and we collaborate with them all the time. And they went out to the camps far earlier than the police department, from what I understand, and made sure people knew what was happening and knew what services were out there. At The Road Home, it's our understanding that people generally know there are services available. They might not be ready to come into shelter. They might prefer camping for a while. But in our experience over many years of doing this and being a major housing provider, supportive housing provider, we know that people might decline services for a while, but at some point they change their minds and decide that they need to come in for services. Or sometimes people are, you know, so mentally ill that they can't reason in order to come in for services. Or, you know, we often say it's the timing. We can work with someone for years and they say, no, I don't, you know, I don't want shelter, I don't want housing. And that's a big focus for us, is the people who live on the streets and are the very most vulnerable in our community and have been homeless for years. That's a big focus.
In the Housing and Community Development Division's 2012 report on homelessness in Utah, they addressed several myths, and one of those was the idea that the homeless population is transient. It says that 88% are Utahns, but I'm wondering about the other 12%. Are they the typical hobo model of getting on a train, or, you know, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
So we believe that it's at least 88%. You know, the population, the demographic we serve in at The Road Home is about 88% Utah residents or have close ties to Utah, were born and raised here, moved away for a little while, came back, that kind of thing. They're Utahns. It is such a myth that people come here just because of our services. And I hear it all the time, even among service providers. Sometimes there's a small group of what you're saying, you know, the old hobo model where they jump trains and things like that. I think there's a small group of people who might come different, you know, go different places for weather or different jobs or, you know, things that are happening like that. But for the most part, people are here,
Great.
You know, and they're not wandering all around the country chasing a better soup kitchen. It just, people are not so, they're just poor. They just need services. They're not in it to trick the system or, you know, manipulate in order to get things. For the most part, for the majority part of it, they just, you know, they find themselves in a really difficult situation. So they're not always behaving perfectly. They're desperate. Especially we see families with little kids, you know, they are desperate to get out of that situation. I often talk about how hard people have to work to get out of homelessness. It is not, we are not giving them services. They have to work. As much as it's a kind interaction and we try to be compassionate and guide people through the process, it's hard and there are lots of stumbles along the way, and it's a lot of work.
Maybe I'll ask for a second on just on that note, the one of the reasons that I think some people, you know, prefer to camp and avoid, you know, shelters and services is because they think of the shelter as a place where, you know, where first off where the homeless people go, and I'm, you know, I don't want to necessarily identify myself as a homeless person, mm-hmm. but also because of you know, drug use, and it's, you know, I know that it's something that's a very tough thing. You said earlier you don't turn anybody away, but there are some people who have alcohol, you know, hard, very difficult problems with alcoholism, drug use. I'm sure there's a criminal element, and also the mental mm-hmm. health issues in general that might scare people away from using your services. Can you talk about that generally, about the sort of stigma of the shelter?
Mm-hmm. I think that that's something we hear from people, that they don't want to come to shelter because of things that are going on in the shelter. I believe that inside the walls of the shelter, it's pretty controlled, and there's not a huge criminal element or theft taking place or, you know, scary, dangerous stuff. But I understand, I mean, that's a very real perception. and it's really intimidating. We hear that a lot of young people who are homeless don't want to come to the road home because of that, you know, that element. So I think it's real.
Yeah.
But I think once people are there and know what it's like inside the shelter and know what to stay away from, I think it's people can navigate it in a healthy way.
Great. What services, Melanie, do you guys provide in regard to housing the homeless?
Well, about 12 years ago, we really transformed our agency from that emergency room model sheltering system to become a housing agency. We changed our name to The Road Home for a lot of reasons. And over the last 12 years, we've developed a robust housing program. We have about 700 households who have come through the sheltering system living out in the community that we still provide support for. So most of those could be considered permanent supportive housing. I messed that up.
Oh, go ahead. Take your time.
Okay. So most of those situations are considered permanent supportive housing, and we provide support to people who have been chronically homeless, the most vulnerable people who we a few years ago never thought could be housed or were very service resistant. We house them very successfully with a 99% rate of housing retention. Families, we have a very sophisticated system where we utilize a housing first approach and then a progressive engagement model.
And what is housing first?
Housing first essentially is that there are no barriers for someone to get into housing. So instead of the old model where you required people to have a job, be sober, be actively seeking mental health treatment, have all your kids in school, that kind of stuff in order to obtain housing, we place them in housing as soon as possible. And then we work on those things while they're in housing. The idea is that people can't overcome those difficult parts of their lives when they're in crisis in an emergency shelter setting, but they can overcome them. And we know that's true while they're in their home.
You guys have seen that. You've seen that played out. You know from your own experience now.
Yeah.
So what is the process of actually getting these people into housing?
What we do is help a person go and talk, you know, introduce themselves to a landlord, talk about what's on their background, apply for the unit. At the same time, we're making sure the person becomes eligible for a subsidy. Mm-hmm. So that's really the name of our game. You have to have the participant, a subsidy, and a landlord, and then a person to provide the supportive services after. And we find that most people, again, about 80 or 90% of people don't need intensive supportive services after they're placed. So we might be doing weekly visits at first, and then we taper down quickly. Our average length of stay or average length of support for a family in our rapid rehousing model is 5 months. And then we back off and they live in the same place. And you would never know if the person living next door to you was homeless or not. They just move in like anyone else and pay their rent and live out their lives.
Can you tell me a little bit about the financial side of providing these services? I know that with the recent sequestration, there have been some difficulties.
You mentioned sequestration, and that is bringing into our community some real difficulty. Our housing authorities have been just, you know, broadsided with budget cuts, especially in the Section 8 program. Section 8 is a permanent federal subsidy for people who are very poor. And what happens when Section 8 is affected like that, and when they stop having a flow of new people being enrolled in a Section 8 subsidy program, is it bottlenecks all the rest of the programs. So, you know, we do an amazing job at The Road Home, and our community partners do an amazing job with what they do, but the resources are always very limited. We talk about all this great success we have in housing and helping people obtain sobriety and maintain sobriety and get mental health treatment. But all the time, we're seeing budget cuts and budget cuts and budget cuts. A lot of the time, what we need is money, all the service providers in the community.
Right.
But if anyone wanted to support the Road Home in that way, or one of our partner agencies. They're good places to put money.
Great. Melanie Zamora, Director of Housing Programs at the Road Home, I want to thank you for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You can find a full version of this discussion at our website, kcpw.org. Tomorrow, we conclude this series of interviews when we speak about the state of Utah's plan for the homeless with Gordon Walker, Director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division. That's tomorrow on The Rundown from KCPW. And thanks for listening to The Rundown. Our program today was produced by Lauren Colucci. And we had help, as always, from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Thanks for joining us today on The Rundown from KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.